the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The capture of Venezuela's dictator Nicolas Maduro has certainly sparked a major international uproar and also sparked significant discussions on the extent and limits of both U.S. power and international law. This week on Register Radio, we're joined by Register contributor Ambassador Alberto Fernandez. And then, with the appointment of a new Archbishop of New York, we look back at the colorful history of our diocese and its remarkable archbishops with Register staff writer Matt McDonald. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, host of Register Radio and EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. I'm joined, as always, by Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Hello, Shannon. How are you?
Great, Matthew. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, the new year has certainly started off with a great deal of news, certainly on the domestic side here in the United States with the Minnesota situation. We're looking at that closely, but then we also have the remarkable events that transpired right after the first of the year in Venezuela. The seizure and arrest of Maduro of Venezuela has certainly created something of a divided global response. And our guest this week just wrote in the Register that to say that the bold U.S. military operation ignited controversy is something of an understatement. Polls showed that the overwhelming majority of Republicans approved of it, while the overwhelming majority of Democrats condemned it. And he goes on to note the global divide on the military strike as well. The author of that analysis, always perfectly timed, is Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, who joins us now. He is a frequent Register contributor. Ambassador, welcome back to Register Radio.
Thank you. It's a real honor to be on with you guys.
I always feel bad in some ways because we always have you on in the midst of international crises, disasters, and points of controversy. So thank you for your endless availability.
It's always something.
Yes, it is. So let's start with the situation as it stands right now, before we get into sort of the divide that's been created globally. Where are we with the so-called Maduro case?
Well, with the Maduro case, of course, it's a legal case now. So it's becomes a judicial issue in the courts of the United States and the District Court or the Southern District of New York City. So that's the Maduro angle. Much more interesting is what's happening on the ground in Venezuela itself, where things are very dynamic.
Yeah, Ambassador, we should note, first of all, before we get into some of the weeds on this, this was an extraordinary military operation. You know, I think breathtaking wouldn't be over-exaggerating it. It was, as the details emerged about what they pulled off is really extraordinary. I think one of the lead helicopter pilots was shot three times, kept the helicopter from going down. I mean, the Trump presidency would look very different today if one of those helicopters had gone down or if there had been a greater loss of life. So I think, that deserves its due. But on the strategic side of things, still days into this, we're still kind of trying to get a sense of what the plan is from the Trump administration. I know he spoke at length with the New York Times earlier this week, talked a little bit about what the plan is, but most of what we're getting, he keeps talking about oil, right?
Well, actually, Americans are kind of focused on that, but there's a lot more happening on the ground. If you speak Spanish and you're following the Venezuelan media and especially the Venezuelan regime, the Maduro regime is a regime that the dictator would go on television for 4 hours and speak about all kinds of stuff. This is something that Hugo Chavez had pioneered before. So they're constantly dealing with the media, regime media, controlled media, but they're, they were a very chatty crowd. Well, we're less than a week into this operation, the follow-on on the Maduro grab, and we've seen Venezuela pick a new president who has agreed to the American terms on oil. On Thursday, on Wednesday, the Venezuelan National Assembly, which is controlled by the Maduro regime, hurriedly passed an amnesty law. On Thursday, they announced that they would begin the liberation of political prisoners. So things are moving very fast. The American embassy in Caracas is expected to open within hours or within days. So that's pretty remarkable considering that we are not occupying Venezuela.
Ambassador, there seem to be a lot of different strategic interests at play here for the United States. And I mean, you've just touched on a couple of them. Can you sort of give us the broad view of what would lead to the decision to topple him? And what are the things that are in the best interest of the United States for doing so, in your view?
Well, first of all, of course, this was kind of previewed, this operation, not specifically, but it was previewed in the national security strategy of the Trump administration, which was written last year and rolled out around Thanksgiving, which really prioritized the Western Hemisphere and prioritized was called the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. I think Trump called it the Donroe Doctrine, which, you know, many of us read with great interest. But of course, you know, documents from Washington often are dead letters. They actually don't mean anything. But this one really talked about prioritizing ties with the Western Hemisphere, making sure that adversaries did not have a toehold into the Western Hemisphere. And of course, Venezuela, even more than Cuba, because Cuba is this way, but Cuba doesn't have the resources. Venezuela really became kind of a center for every adversary of the United States worldwide, from the big dogs of Russia and China to terrorist groups to jihadist groups, Hezbollah. They were close allies of the defunct Assad regime, narco business of every sort. So Venezuela had really become this pole of a united gathering of anti-American forces challenging the United States. And that was something that the administration saw kind of strategically as a real challenge that they needed to deal with. Then basically there's the kind of tactical part that Venezuela presented certain advantages. You know, it's a largest oil reserves in the world, and lots of other things as well. So kind of a bunch of different factors seem to have come together, and a decision made in the administration to move, a very bold decision, as Shannon noted. It could have gone wrong so easily, and it didn't.
Ambassador, a couple of weeks ago, you wrote presciently about a pending U.S. action and what that might look like in Venezuela. And you said at that time that some are worried that Trump will go too far, and others are worried that he won't go far enough. In your estimation, what is too far and what is not far enough?
Well, I think, you know, it was prescient. I didn't have any crystal ball, but too far was basically the concern that the American people have that we would be dragged down in one more time in another open-ended conflict and kind of open-ended situation of nation building. You know, we spent a couple of trillion dollars nation building the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan and Iraq, the close ally of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So the American people clearly would have seen that as too much. You know, if there'd been a heavy loss of American life, that certainly would have affected public opinion in the United States. Now, not enough. I think many people who've suffered under the heel of the regime, a horrendous regime, the Maduro regime killed 10,000 Venezuelans over the last decade. 10,000 Venezuelan civilians were killed by the security forces in Venezuela. People don't talk about that. But the fear was that the administration would maybe remove Maduro and make a deal with the regime, or come to a deal with Maduro. That was another concern that many people in Latin America and many people in Venezuela had as well.
Yeah, Ambassador, you note in your analysis piece that this has not just ignited controversy, but it has divided unsurprisingly, in the United States, the Republicans and Democrats, many Democrats who, for the record, had actually called for Maduro's ouster not that many years ago, but also globally. But I'm noticing, as you note, with the president, French President Emmanuel Macron, who did not criticize the United States at all, that it doesn't seem to be running entirely along the obvious ideological lines. So where is this divide falling?
Well, I think the divide is falling, to be blunt, where people are not obsessed with Trump and with the United States. That people can look at the larger picture. So, for example, it's been overwhelmingly positively received in most of Latin America, including in countries in Latin America where the leadership, the president, criticized the American action. So, for example, in Mexico and in Colombia, the leaders of those countries criticized the U.S. action. But polls show that a majority, or a plurality in the case of Mexico, actually agreed with the operation removing Maduro. So these are people that clearly can see, well, it's not all about Trump. It's not all about even the United States, that the removal of this cruel dictator is a good thing, that Venezuela has difficult days, but this is a country where 86% of the population of the country lives in poverty, even though it has the largest oil reserves in the world. So many people saw it. Whatever you think of Trump, we're glad that this happened. That's the divide.
Ambassador, we only have a minute or so, but can we talk a little bit briefly about Cuba? They have had a very close relationship with Maduro. The reports that you see is, you know, economically things are maybe as bad as they've ever been in Cuba right now. What are you looking at in the Cuban situation?
Well, Cuba's imploding internally, economically, in every sense of the word. They had bet, bizarre considering the history of the Cuban Revolution, they had bet that their saving grace was tourism and free oil from Maduro. Well, free oil from Maduro is not happening anymore. And after COVID, tourism to Cuba never really returned. People found cheaper and better places to go on Caribbean trips. So the regime is imploding in every sense of the word. Cuba's lost 20% of its population over the last 5-6 years, mostly young people fleeing to the West. So the regime is under more pressure, I think, than it's ever been in its history. The challenge is, do the Americans intervene in any way, direct or indirect, or do they basically stand back and let the regime implode on its own?
I can anticipate a revisiting with you in the very near future, Ambassador. Thank you for coming on and for the perspective you added to the Register.
Thank you, gentlemen.
You're listening to Register Radio on EWTN Radio. Next up, we talk with Register staff writer Matt McDonald about the fabled history of the Archdiocese of New York. This is Register Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, as always, with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, Pope Leo XIV chose Bishop Ronald Hicks of the Diocese of Joliet, Illinois, to be the next Archbishop of New York. It's been described as the most consequential U.S. Episcopal appointment of Leo's pontificate thus far. But it also is a reminder, a very helpful reminder, of the immense significance of the Archdiocese of New York and its archbishops. We took a look at both the Archdiocese and its shepherds, thanks to the work of Matt McDonald of the National Catholic Register, who has several pieces looking at that very question, and he joins us now. So Matt, welcome back to Register Radio.
Thanks, Matthew.
So what is it about the Archdiocese of New York that is just so compelling?
We start with size. It's big in land, but huge in people.
But that really doesn't capture it, because even when the population of Catholics has been decreasing, as it has been in recent decades, it still captures the imagination. And that has to do with the pizzazz of New York, it being the commercial capital and cultural capital and media capital.
Yeah, Matt, as you say in your piece, Archbishop-elect Hicks has some big shoes to fill in New York. I mean, and just for a moment, just to give some context, I mean, he'll have his work cut out for him. We know already. First of all, there's been this huge political change in New York City that he's walking into, and the Archdiocese is in the midst of selling off something like $300 million worth of property to settle its clergy abuse claims. But your piece gets into sort of some of these larger than life figures who have held this role. I want to get right into one of them, which is Dagger John. And can you start with him, and we can go from there? But I know you found him to be a particularly colorful figure.
If we start with Dagger John and happen to run out of time, it's okay. John Hughes was born in what's now called Northern Ireland and came over to the United States as a young man. And he had a rough go trying to become a priest. He had very little education. He worked as a ditch digger. At one point, he's working on a road project in Pennsylvania, and this is rich lawyer that comes along, and he can't get across because the road's all dug up. So he's going to turn around in his carriage, and Dagger John says to him, "No, let's we're going to carry your carriage and you across the way." Turns out that's the future president of the United States, James Buchanan. Whose family in Northern Ireland, the Protestants, the Hughes family knew, and they had a nice conversation. Dagger John reminded of him that years later in the White House when he's meeting him. He was a force. When he got to New York in the early 1840s, the place was falling apart. The Catholic community was falling apart. People hated Catholics, and it wasn't really clear that the Diocese of New York was even viable. But through his debating, his speaking, his strength, constantly debating Protestants over fine points of theology and history, but also standing up for his people, he made really the Archdiocese of New York what we think of as today. And one example, which I know you're familiar with, Shannon, is that when in Philadelphia, mobs burned down, anti-Catholic mobs burned down two Catholic churches and killed about seven people. And the same thing looked like it was going to happen in New York. Hughes went to the mayor of New York, who was a Protestant, and the mayor asked him, "Are you worried about your churches?" And Bishop Hughes said, "We're not worried about ours, we're worried about yours."
Yeah, I mean, the history of the archbishops, too, and they've been people of rather dazzling personalities, too. I mean, we tend to think of very buttoned-up American bishops in the 19th century, but we can't have a discussion of the archbishops of New York without talking about Francis Cardinal Spellman.
An astonishing figure, a force also, despite being very short and having a high-pitched nasal voice, not being a great speaker, but a powerful figure, just astonishing. One of the surprising things to me from doing these stories is the easy access to power that many archbishops of New York have had. Nobody like Cardinal Spellman. And by power, I mean within the church, certainly. He was a dear friend of Pope Pius XII, who is the one who appointed him Archbishop of New York. They had vacationed together in Europe when neither one was as well known as he became later. But also the secular power. I was astonished to see what easy access he had to President Franklin Roosevelt. He was a frequent guest in the White House and at Roosevelt's home in Hyde Park, New York, to the point where at one point Spellman actually helped work on a speech with Franklin Roosevelt that Roosevelt was going to give. His residence was known as the Powerhouse, and it was because of him. If it wasn't that he could make things happen that he wanted to have happen. But it was almost like he had a veto power on things he didn't want to have happen. If you wanted something done and you might be worried about what the Archbishop of New York might think of it, you really wanted to get his say-so before you went forward.
Yeah, Matt, I think it was John Paul II who referred to the Archbishop of New York as the Archbishop of America. And that wasn't always the case. I mean, New York as a Catholic center happened, you know, more kind of midway through the country's history. What was more prominent in the United States?
More prominent in terms of religion, of course. The country was founded as a Protestant country. There were Catholics, and there were a few other people, but overwhelmingly Protestant. And to the point where, when Catholics start showing up in large numbers in the 1830s and 1840s, there's a big conflict over, among other things, the public schools. In New York, the assumption was, as in many places, that religion should be part of the public schools. There was no sense that of a strict separation of church and state the way people talk about today, because it was actually read from the Bible. But it was a Protestant Bible from a Protestant perspective. And John Hughes stood up and said, no, if you're going to have religion, let's have it so that Catholics don't feel like they're left out. He even wanted public funding for Catholic schools, which he didn't get, but he formed Catholic schools in the city of New York. Other bishops did as well elsewhere. And eventually you have this Catholic culture that's elbowing its way into the broader American culture. It's an effort by the bishops broadly in the United States, but especially in New York, to make sure that Catholics stay Catholic and that Catholic children remain Catholic.
Yeah, and sort of lost in some of this discussion is, let's hop back just for a second to John Hughes and answer the question which people often ask is, why does he have the name Dagger John?
Sure. So, like many bishops, he signed his letters with a cross. But when the letters got reproduced in a newspaper, the symbol that was used was not a cross, but rather a dagger, which was the closest thing that the typesetters had. Protestants didn't understand this. They didn't understand the idea of signing your name with a cross. To them, it looked like a dagger, but it also spoke to them about his personality, because he was a strong personality, sarcastic, funny, someone who would never let an attack go unanswered, and he'd usually win. The way he became Bishop of New York, actually, in part, was taking on a Protestant minister in the newspapers and in public debates and getting the better of him because of his arguments, certainly his intellect, but also his force of personality.
Mm-hmm. And then we can't have any discussion about the Archbishops of New York. I mentioned Francis Cardinal Spellman. We have Terence Cook, who has a cause for canonization that was opened. He's now a servant of God. We have Cardinal John O'Connor, who is this towering figure, who actually influenced the U.S. elections with some of his remarkable pro-life work. But we have to mention the outgoing Archbishop of New York, Timothy Cardinal Dolan.
Yes, Cardinal Dolan, of course, retired officially in December 2025 as Archbishop. He's now the administrator of the Archdiocese. There's a couple of classic things that you have to mention about him. One is this idea of coming from somewhere else, coming to New York and fitting in. And there have been a number of Archbishops of New York who have been from other places, like Spellman from Massachusetts, like Cardinal Egan from Chicago, and Cardinal Dolan, who's originally from St. Louis and then later became the Archbishop of Milwaukee. You also have to think of him in terms of evangelizing. The authors of a book called The Sons of St. Patrick, George Marlin and Brad Miner, call him the evangelist. And that's because of the effective way he had of speaking both in St. Patrick's Cathedral in sermons that were heard by the congregants, but also carried by television stations and online. But also, especially, I think most Americans know him from television, the easy way that he has with television hosts. One online source says that he's made 123 appearances on Fox and Friends. And that doesn't account the other Fox shows, That doesn't count the other major networks, NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN. He's been on television all over the place and always comes across as an effective spokesman.
Yeah. Well, Matt, thank you for all of your work on this. It's a wonderful reminder of how fascinating American Catholic history is, but also as we now embark on this anniversary year for the founding of the country, how fascinating the whole of American Catholic history is and how we can celebrate that history in this coming year. That's it for this week here on Register Radio. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks again for joining us. On behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, and Shannon Mullen, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Until next time, please take care and God bless.